This Week in Retronauts, we're totally stacked. Everyone, welcome to yet another fine episode of Retronauts here on the East Coast. Yes, it's Retronauts East. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this week it's just me and
Ben Elgin.
And it's the two of us because why is that? I guess because we're talking about something fairly obscure, and none of our other East Coast regulars were really on board with it and really knew much about it. Not that I know that much about it either. I'm kind of out of my depth.
Fortunately, I was an enormous HyperCard nerd back in the day.
Oh, so. You spoiled it. Yeah, that's what our topic is this week. We are talking about HyperCard, which we have mentioned in a previous episode. And we're also talking about, sort of as the B-side to this episode, the Myst series, which we've also mentioned in a previous episode. We've touched on these things, but we've never gone really in depth with them. And this is not, like, I would say necessarily an essential, crucial, pivotal part of video games and video game history, but it's interesting, and it's one of those little, like, ecosystems that kind of cropped up. You know, you see things like, I don't know, like dating sims in Japan, or like games that came with tape cassettes of music, you know, just kind of one of these, like, niche topics, and this is one of those, and it just happens that Ben was someone who was pretty heavily invested in this.
Yeah, and there were definitely a lot of things that grew out of it. So even though it didn't necessarily directly hit a whole lot of the gaming public, I think it definitely had an effect.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we're talking about Myst, and Myst emerged from HyperCard, and until The Sims came along, that was the single best-selling PC game of all time.
Yeah, so for a decade.
For nearly a decade, it basically ruled the sales charts. So to say, you know, HyperCard is of no consequence would be completely incorrect. It definitely touched into the mainstream, even if, you know, people didn't realize that it was there. No one picked up Myst and were like, oh, this is just a HyperCard stack. Because, you know, it was heavily modified and so on and so forth. And we'll talk about that. But definitely HyperCard had an impact and touched on many, many people's lives, even if they didn't realize it, even if they weren't necessarily Macintosh users. And as with many things related to Macintosh, it was sort of something generally restricted to that small cult audience of Mac. But but as with many things to do with Macintosh, it eventually rippled outward and became part of the mainstream.
And also within that, the Mac cult at the time, it was actually pretty ubiquitous, and it was a big part of, like, the shareware scene, just because it was so easy to dive into and make your own stuff, that a lot of the things that were being distributed on an amateur basis came out of HyperCard.
And I guess that's maybe where we should start, is that it was kind of like this simple do-it-yourself approach. It was kind of the Unity of its day, I would almost say. It was meant a very easy to pick up programming application, not really a language. It did use a language of its own, but
yeah, it had a language, but that was kind of the second step.
Right.
So on the surface, it had a lot of easily manipulable elements that you could just kind of plug and play in what you needed for a particular app. And then if you needed to go further, there's this whole extremely robust scripting language behind it to let you do other stuff.
But it was not specifically a video game application.
The idea
was not, oh yes, people are going to make their own video games with this. It was, people will create their own sort of applications, their own projects.
Your own custom Rolodex was sort of the top level sell on this, which is why it's, you know, cards and stacks. But it's, so, you know, if you need to keep track of something and there's not a program out there to do it for you, roll your own, you know, make whatever you need to keep track of your information and link it together, basically.
Yeah, the custom Rolodex, that's a good metaphor, because back when computers, microcomputers were new and the computing industry was trying to sell America on the idea that, yes, you should own a computer. It is good to spend $6,000 on this box that's going to sit in your home. you know, that was a tough sell because computers back then were relatively very expensive and very limited. And one of the big sales pitches was the sort of ubiquitous use cases that was always given was, oh, well, you can have, you know, your recipes all filed away digitally. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of funny to think about now because, you know, my grandmother's old recipe card box, you know, these like index cards, my mother still has those. She still uses them. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother, I'm sure, did put stuff on computer, but it was like an old K-Pro, and I have no idea what happened to those files. Like,
yeah.
But the idea was that you would, you know, all the things you needed to do in the home, like file recipes, you know, it wasn't just for men. Women who had to cook could also use computers. they were these valuable tools that everyone could use, and they would make everyone's lives better. Well, HyperCard was the next iteration of that, like, you know, recipe card box concept with everything being cross-linked and connected and, you know, a real sort of database being created in a transparent and intuitive way. So you didn't really think about the fact that you were, you know, organizing all these systems underneath. It was just cards, video visual cards.
Yeah, it was sort of an extension of, excuse me, Apple's whole desktop metaphor that you had and their push into desktop publishing, that, you know, you could have pages that were what you would do on a typewriter or a publishing setup. And this was kind of the everything else of the desktop, you know, something that wasn't just a text document or just an image. This is where you could bring things together and put them together in whatever way you wanted. And that was actually some of the first things I did with it was go with that top level Rolodex metaphor. And I made like my own custom database for Nintendo Power issues. So I could remember, look up like what articles were where in my huge stack of Nintendo Powers.
Do you still have that around? Because that would be actually really handy for me as I'm doing retrospectives.
I could probably bring it back up in emulation.
Is that one of things on archive.org?
Sure. It's not on archive.org. But it is on my disk at home. I know I have that. I could, you know, it'll cover like early 90s for a few years, probably.
Man, that'd be awesome.
I could try to bring it up.
HyperCard still saving lives 25, 30 years later.
Yeah. So I had that. I had some EGM. I had a different stack for some EGM stuff. And then I had a stack for Magic the Gathering cards because I had a whole huge database of those. And I made one to keep track of the BBS users in my local area code because I was in a weirdly active bulletin board system dial-up area code back in the early 90s. So yeah, that was the top level stuff is just, you know, use it to organize your things and link your information together. And that was really easy to do because it came with this metaphor where you have, you know, anytime you open up a new one, you have this stack of cards and you can put shared fields for text that go all through your stack. So, you know, you can have a title field and a content field, and then you can search these fields and you can have buttons that will link from one place to another, or do, you know, pre-saved custom searches and all kinds of things like that. And that's really easy to do without really getting into any code at all. So that was sort of the top level set.
You know, I think we're talking here and people who aren't familiar with HyperCard may be thinking, this sounds a lot just like the internet. And that's not a coincidence. Like the modern day internet, especially, well, you know, even more so the internet of the 90s and early 2000s was very similar in structure and concept to HyperCard. And in fact, you know, the basis of the World Wide Web is hypertext markup language. And it's not a coincidence that these two things are called hyper. They both relate to sort of a metaphor of interlinking data through links and through an interface where you can easily jump from one object to another, and they're all sort of organized within a hierarchy. And as with many things that Apple did that were innovative and interesting, they didn't invent this concept. They didn't invent the desktop, you know, graphical user interface. They swiped that from Xerox PARC. And HyperCard was actually created by the guy who did the graphics programming for, like, the graphics engine programming for Macintosh, Bill Atkinson. He was one of the guys who went to Xerox PARC and was like, Steve Jobs, you need to steal this. It is such a good thing. It is so great. We need to make a computer around this. And this was his next phase. Like, after they created the Macintosh system, Bill went on to say, well, this is really great, but what we really need is, like, a miniature computer that you could hold in your hand and use a touchscreen to, you know, make use of this visual metaphor. Well, that wouldn't come along for another 25 years. He was a little ahead of his time. I mean, you know, even Star Trek didn't have, like, wasn't around with a pad back then. And you know, the, what was it? John Scully and his virtual valet or whatever. This was all around the same time. Like, you know, the thought was
the ideas
there.
Were out there. Yeah.
Yeah. But it didn't yet. Like, the tech just wasn't there. I mean, you wouldn't even get the Newton for another 10 years. So sort of stymied with this, Atkinson was like, well, I can't basically create this entire new space of computing because the tech isn't there. But what if we, you know, what if we sort of applied that concept back into the Macintosh and sort of took the visual interface and the idea of interlinking concepts together? And so HyperCard was basically like a worldwide web that wasn't worldwide. It was just a web on your computer. It was
or a tablet that wasn't on a tablet.
Right.
And it really
it was contained
like
to your computer.
Like the way it came out of the box, you have this home stack, which is basically, which it comes up and it has a bunch of links to other utility stacks. And it honestly, it looks like a smartphone screen. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you have this main page and you have just a few rows of little icons that are single click links to small applications that do other stuff. And so really, yeah, I mean, if the tech had been there, he would have built an iPad at that time. And this was sort of what he could do instead.
But again, Apple didn't create this concept. Bill Atkinson didn't create this concept. I don't know if he took the concept from somewhere else, if he actually knew what was out there floating around. I have to guess he did.
I think so, yeah.
But just as the Mac user interface was inspired by Xerox PARC's work, the Palo Alto Research Center, the concept of HyperCard, hypertext, like that term was actually coined in the 1960s by a Harvard graduate named Ted Nelson. And he came up with the concept of hypertext where, you know, words link to other words and you navigate information, turning the concept of reading and information organization into an active process. And he came up with a concept called Xanadu, which never quite came to fruition. And apparently he's very, very sort of like this very embittered person about the World Wide Web.
That's unfortunate.
And feels like, you know, Tim Berners-Lee and everyone totally ripped him off.
Yeah.
And maybe they did.
I mean, it really is. His whole concept is everything we take for granted today. But back then, it was really pie in the sky. I think, you know, I mean, it was the concept of basically linking all the world's information together. And that was ridiculously out there at the time. And now it's just, well, that's the web. Okay.
Yeah. He just didn't have the resources available to him. Just like Bill Atkinson had to abandon his tablet project and create HyperCard instead. Ted Nelson, he never had the resources and the tech available in the time he needed it to be. But instead of saying, okay, let's step back and do something different, he kept working at it. And his idea for Xanadu is still out there. I think Xanadu.org or something, if you go there, it's still, he's still blogging the idea. I think a lot of people sort of see him as a crackpot, which is unfortunate because he was so far ahead of his time with this concept. Again, 1960s, that's crazy that this idea goes that far back. But, you know, again, so much of kind of what comes to fruition in terms of tech is it's not so much of like who comes up with the idea first, but who can turn it into something usable, who can distill it into a product that you know the public can make use of.
Yeah, what is the right thing at the right time for what you can actually accomplish?
And HyperCard wasn't quite the right thing at the right time, but it was closer. It definitely had its loyal users. It made it to the world as a product. not one that made Apple rich, but that wasn't the point. The point was more, it was kind of one of the company's final sort of like, this is for the good of everyone kind of.
Yeah, I mean, then they actually, so Atkinson actually managed to sell it to Scully, who was, I mean, sell it in a metaphorical sense, who was the CEO at the time. A lot of people thought that he wouldn't go for this, but he actually saw that this was a really cool thing that could get people into solving their own problems. And so they ended up bundling it for free for several years with Mac OS.
That's kind of a, you know, I don't want to get too digressive here, but John Scully, I feel like he is sort of disliked by Apple fanatics. He was the guy who stepped in after Steve Jobs was ousted, and it was partially his fault that Steve Jobs was ousted back in the early, you know, the mid 80s around that, after the launch of the Macintosh. And you know, he came from Pepsi, I think, PepsiCo.
Yeah,
and so he was like a soda.
He was the business guy.
And so people like see him as, you know, the death of Apple, but you know, despite the fact that he did come from that background, I still feel like a lot of the things that, you know, you look back at and read some of the stuff he wrote, and you know, his project about the Navigator or whatever it was called, the Digital Valet, like he was open to innovation and to good product ideas beyond just like, will this make us a lot of money? There was still a little bit of idealism in him, or at least that's how
I definitely think in hindsight, you know, he was not without any vision. It's just, you know, compared next to Steve Jobs, it's hard to look like not stodgy.
But Apple would have much less visionary leaders over time, like Guillermilio.
Yeah, I mean, the really boring periods came even later.
But. Yeah, like once Scully left, then it really went downhill. But yeah, this was a point where Scully was like, you know what, this is actually pretty cool, and so he greenlit HyperCard, and it launched for free. It was going to be included on new Macintoshes for free, and if you already owned a Macintosh, you could buy the discs for like $50, which is, you know, pretty reasonable.
And I think he also remembered at that point still, like, everything, you know, Atkinson had done. Now, like we were saying earlier, Atkinson had done the original drawing code for all the entire Macintosh platform. And he also came up with MacPaint, which was really revolutionary.
And QuickDraw
was the routines underneath. Yeah. But MacPaint was the actual painting program. And at the time, that was also revolutionary. You know, it was to desktop publishing, or sorry, it was for drawing what the other Mac apps were to desktop publishing. Mm-hmm. And that it was one of the first things that really let people go to town in this new all pixel world, basically.
Yeah, those are my memories. My earliest memories of the Macintosh are using MacPaint to create dumb little, you know, like black and white images. You know,
and
it's 1-bit color, but
if you go back and look, like, its interface is pretty clearly the progenitor of, you know, everything that came after Photoshop, Illustrator, all those things.
Yep. So he was a guy who was very like forward thinking and did a great job of distilling big ideas into something that was extremely usable.
He had a gift for accessibility.
So there was that's pretty rare, like engineering savvy and the ability to think like, what will people find intuitive? I mean, it's hard to find people who understand intuitive design, period.
Yeah.
Certainly people who are leading the way for World Wide Web interface websites these days. I'm just like, unless you've spent a lot of time working with websites, like a lot of, you know, nested menus and things like that, those aren't intuitive.
I mean, honestly.
And his palettes and everything.
Honestly, to this day, you know, I end up doing UI design sometimes for other jobs, and I feel like a whole lot of the good things I actually know about UI design can all trace back to him.
I don't want to spend too much time dwelling on the prehistory of HyperCard and the history. As with all of our computer-based Retronauts discussions, the best place to find reading information on this, reading material about this, is the Digital Antiquarian. He's written some really great pieces on the history and prehistory of hypertext, or Yeah, hypertext and hypercard. Mm-hmm. So please check out that site. Support that guy on Patreon. He does great work. Every Friday, he publishes a new article about the history and evolution of classic computers. And so he's done some great research and some really good job of distilling all that research into useful articles that people like me can pilfer for their podcasts.
Indeed.
So that's where HyperCard comes from. And it debuted in 1987. It was distributed, like I said, for free on new Macintoshes. I think it made its debut at like Worldwide Developer Conference or Macworld or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, it was one of the big conferences. Yeah.
And immediately set the world on fire. Like, not the entire world, but the world of tech-savvy, media-savvy, computer-savvy people pretty universally recognized, like, this is a big, big deal. And, of course, like I said before, HyperCard was extremely limited by the fact that it was bound, you know, the stacks you created. This was before common networking, before the World Wide Web, you know, became universal. So it was very sort of limited in that sense. But, you know, even the at the very beginning, the idea of getting it onto a network existed. One of the first groups of people who were sort of inducted into HyperCard, you know, given sort of an early run at it by Apple, were the users of the well, the whole Earth Electric Link, I think is what it's called, which is something that kind of predates my time on the internet. But I was using the internet early enough, you know, in the early to mid 90s, that I remember seeing, you know, well mentioned with sort of like this gushing reverence by publications like Wired. They were just like, like everything comes from well.
Yeah, I wasn't really on it, but I definitely, you know, had it. It was in my consciousness.
So well was an online group that shared information and they had their own sort of online database that sort of predates Wikipedia. And Apple was like, well, why don't you turn this into a HyperCard stack? So they did. And of course, you know, that wasn't networked. You couldn't just like log on and check it out anywhere in the world. But it was just like, it just needed that one little connection. The idea was there. The germ was there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, HyperCard was definitely very progressive, very innovative, and very had enormous potential.
Yeah, and we had, you know, we still had distribution networks then. It just wasn't, you know, the web didn't exist yet. But you could still transfer things through, you know, FTP or Gopher and all that stuff.
You could definitely
still get your stuff out there.
You could download or upload stacks and run them on your local system. It just didn't work with the sort
of distributed
system of the World Wide Web.
Direct links from in your stacks because that just really wasn't a thing yet where that would be an interface that would be available. Although actually the other way they were distributed a lot is just on diskettes, because you had, and we touched on this in another micro that may or may not have gone out yet, that you had companies that would basically just be a warehouse for redistribution of shareware and freeware and things people had made, that they would put out these catalogs of everything people had submitted to them, and then they just put together floppies and send them to you. And so you get stuff that way as well from other people. That was actually a pretty big distribution network for HyperCard at the time in the early 90s.
Little sending out your software in a little plastic baggie, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, or you send it once. Yeah, you send it once to these distribution centers and have them like copy it, because people would pay them a nominal fee for the copying and the disks, and they would just copy whatever you wanted onto disks and ship it out to you.
So before we start talking about what we're really here to discuss, which is the gaming applications for HyperCard, can you explain a little bit about how it actually worked? I tried using HyperCard after it was sort of obsolete, and I didn't have anyone to explain it to me. So I sat down and was like, what am I doing? Like, there was no, I didn't have any documentation or anything. I was just kind of at a loss. There was HyperCard for Dummies
book. I didn't bring those with me. I have like several thousand pages of documentation. There were some big books that came out.
This was supposed to be simple.
Well, it depends how far you dig into it. So there's multiple levels. So again, at the top level, as we already mentioned, you have in your basic HyperCard, you have a stack that's made up of cards. And so you have kind of a concept of foreground and background. So you can have a background that's shared between a whole bunch of cards and then stuff that's in the foreground on each card. So like for a simple database, you know, you'd put in, so there's a tool that's just like make text fields. So, you know, you put in text fields for whatever data you're going to enter and you put those on the background. So they're shared between all the cards. And then in the foreground, you would enter different data on each card. So that's your basic Rolodex. And then you could have, say, you know, a button that's going to search a particular text field or whatever. And so there's easy tools for creating these fields, for creating these buttons, for making them do simple things. And you can, again, because this is, you know, from the same guy that did Mac Paint, it's all very easy tools for moving things around the screen and positioning them how you want it. And you can add graphics and that sort of thing.
So this actually sounds more sophisticated than pure hypertext. It sounds like there are application, not full application, but like mathematical functions that can be assigned to beyond just like click link and go to other cards.
So that's the next level, is sitting behind this, there's a complete full-featured scripting language. And it's a complete programming language under the hood. So you can basically write whatever you want in this. And it has a lot of cool features to it. So, you know, like I said, it's a complete language. It can do anything, but it's sort of engineered to look friendly from the outside. So it's very natural language. There's not a lot of weird punctuation and syntax. A lot of the things can be written almost as if you're writing English. And it actually has a lot of cute shortcuts that help ease people into it. So there's like this global variable that's always there that is just this, the default variable, and it's just named it. And so you can do things like, you can type in a script, you can say get 5, add 8 to it, put the results in the answer field. And that's almost literally what you would type. Get 5, add 8 to it, put it into answer. Because it is this global variable. So when you say get 5, it's just putting that number 5 into this global variable that's the default variable. And you said add 8 to it, and it's adding 8 into that variable. And so then you would get 13 in your answer field. Hmm. And so there's cute things like that where you can almost type English. And once you're into it as a programmer, you know, the fact that there's this thing named it doesn't really matter. You're going to be using your own variables. But for getting people into the idea of what you can do, I think some of those little tricks are super useful. But so then, yeah, once you do get into it, you can do almost anything. So you can, you can obviously create buttons and fields ahead of time, but you can also script anything you can do. So you can say, you know, move this button from here to here in a script. And so this is where we get into the ability to do game-like things. Because if you take a button and you can make the borders invisible and you can put a graphic on it, and now it suddenly looks an awful lot like a sprite. And you can tell in a script that sprite where to move or to change its graphic or to do, you know, all kinds of things. And suddenly there's a whole lot of opportunities to do whatever you want here. So depending on how far you get into it, you can make it do increasingly ridiculous things. So like, if you're thinking about developing games with a HyperCard, like the obvious top level thing, which a lot of people did, is to make a point and click adventure. And obviously this is going to take us to Manhole and Mist when we get there. Because, you know, a point and click adventure is basically just moving through a series of scenes with some interactive elements, right? So, you know, you have this series of cards and each of them has a scene on it, and you click a place on one of them and it's an invisible button that takes you to a different scene. Or you click on a button and it picks up something and you have something keeping track of your inventory. And that's all really quite easy to do, in HyperCard. So there was a lot of like point and click adventures that came out of this. But then, like I said, you know, using buttons to make sprites and things, you can get increasingly ridiculous. So I made like an overhead perspective engine where you could move around a button like it was a character moving around. And I had a system where I had maps where I would just draw stuff on the screen for a map, but then I had an invisible field in the background, a series of ones and zeros that said collision detection for that map. So where you could go and where you couldn't go. And then you basically have an overhead like Final Fantasy map engine. And then I used that and actually made a game out of that one. And then I did increasingly completely ridiculous things, like actually make an action 2D side scroller engine, which is really not what this sort of thing is designed for. And it's kind of slow, but it actually kind of worked. Cause you can do fun things like everything is a container in this language. So you can put scripts into any, and like any button can have its own script inside it. A field can have its own script inside it. So like I had a button that represented an enemy that had basically its own AI behaviors, in a script in that button. And then just a global thing that would call each button that was on the screen and tell it to do its thing in an idle loop.
So would you say that being able to do things like that in HyperCard speaks to HyperCard's flexibility, or does it speak to the determination of creative types to turn anything into a video game, to like brute force entertainment out of something, no matter how inappropriate?
I think all of the above. It was clearly designed to be very flexible. Because you could make something much more small scale that could still do the like Rolodex kind of things that was the top level application. But they decided to put this completely full featured language behind it. I think knowing that people would find weird things to do with it because they wanted people to solve their own problems. Now, did they think someone was going to try to make an action game out of it? I really don't think so.
the Rolodex.
Yeah, the action Rolodex. No, like I said, I have like 3,000 pages. So I just pulled all these out last night of like documentation books and HyperCard. And the word game is not actually mentioned in any index of any of those books.
That's so kind of Apple's MO from that period. Steve Jobs especially was like determined that people not see the Macintosh as a toy. And that went away over time.
Right. But yeah, that was sort of a backlash.
It definitely stunted the evolution of video games on Macintosh, but HyperCard was pretty cool because once that application came out and people had it on their system, Stax kind of functioned like standalone applications.
Yeah, actually, as of HyperCard 2.2, I think it was, there was actually a function in it to export your stack as a standalone. So you didn't need the base program anymore to run it. Huh. It would just bundle it onto your stack and run.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Like I said, I didn't really use HyperCard that much as a programmer.
One of the things they did encourage people to do that it was built around was interesting presentations as well. It was also sort of, in addition to being Rolodex, it was also kind of the PowerPoint of the day, but an even more flexible PowerPoint in that, I was talking about with adventure games, you can have all these screens with just different information on them and interesting branching ways to navigate between them. And that's good for presentations too. But it's also very close to being an adventure game. So, you could there was all this documentation on how to make interesting multimedia presentations, with branching hierarchies and searchability and all that stuff. And a ton of that you could take and just apply to an adventure game.
So how come HyperCard never evolved? It did to a degree, but like technologically it never managed to get its way out of, system 3. It was always black and white.
That was one of the big
drawbacks is that it didn't expand to embrace the march of technology. Once Max went 32-bit, the HyperCard would have come along, but it didn't.
It had a few versions where it gained a few things, like we were just saying, the ability to export your stacks and that sort of thing. It relied really heavily on expandability on like third party stuff. So I actually had a ton of basically plugins, and we'll talk about this more with Myst, that would let you do things like add movies or add different sounds that weren't supported by the basic program or different kinds of graphics that weren't supported by the basic program and just kind of have those as overlays these external commands would let you put them on cards or let you put them on buttons and do things with them. And so for a lot of that, I think it just relied on extensibility. And for a while, there was a lot of support. The first few years, there was a lot of support for that. One of the big problems, I was reading this in one of the articles the other night, that sort of took the winds out of the sails, is after a few years, Apple spun off. That was the point when Apple spun off all its software to Claris.
Right.
So none of Apple software was being developed in-house for a while. They put it to a separate company that was trying to make its own profits. And that was when suddenly HyperCard wasn't free anymore. Like the base version, if you didn't have it before, suddenly cost like $200. And that took a huge amount of Windows sales because suddenly, not every new hobbyist had this thing anymore.
Right. And not only that, but $200 was a lot at that point. But also, they were asking money for this thing that used to be free, but they hadn't, substantially improved it. It wasn't like
they
released HyperCard Next, where everything was color and had, a System 7 interface and so on.
And it was actually even worse than that because restricting the quantity of new users like that also made it hard for these third parties that were enhancing it to make any money selling their enhancements because there just weren't as many new users. And so a lot of them
Who were buying the software were like, I don't want to pay money on a plugin too.
Yeah. And so So a lot of them folded up, and sort of the enhancements kind of ground to a halt at that point too. And Claris was eventually folded back into Apple, but I think at that point it was just, it had just lost momentum. And you know, not there, there wasn't new stuff going on because of this period when nobody knew had it. And so, yeah, it just kind of, it kind of fell by the wayside. You know, I don't know, behind the scenes, I think the teams were working on other things at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of soldiered along on life support until after Steve Jobs came back.
Yeah, it was supported for a while.
Years after, more than 10 years. No, I guess it was like 10 or 11 years after its debut.
Yeah.
But yeah, at that point, you know, he kind of pulled the plug on a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, I was still
licensing and that sort of thing.
I was still using it for ridiculous things for class projects up into to 2000 and or something.
I tried doing a HyperCard project in like 1997, and my professor was like, really? HyperCard?
By
that point, it was already, you know, kind of considered obsolete.
I wrote a machine language interpreter in HyperCard, which was
How
also
does that even work?
Ridiculous. I mean, it's just, it's actually was pretty straightforward, because it's just, you know, machine language is just, you have a bunch of registers that are little tiny memory chunks, and you're doing very basic operations on them. So I just had a stack that had a whole bunch of fields that were memory registers and buttons that did basic operations on them and scripted machine language operations. And it was worked perfectly fine. It was just a very weird thing to do.
I don't know if HyperCard was necessarily one of the inspirations there, but I feel like it was one of the reasons Apple needed to come up with the iTunes App Store style model, where, you know, you have a platform and then the things you put on that platform are what you charge for. Like iTunes, you get for free.
Yeah.
You know, you buy your phone and the App Store is on it, but it gives you like its extensibility for your device or for your application, or in the case of iTunes, your media. And you know, kind of do the microtransaction approach.
Yeah, I mean, HyperCard
if it had existed, HyperCard might have been, you know, a good pioneer for that model.
It was very much an early platform, you know, on which people built other little useful and fun things. That was very much the model for when it was around.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much we can say with the gaming stuff on here. Like I said, I didn't do any programming, and I only played a few HyperCard games. I did go back to try some out before this episode, and if you go to archive.org, as with many things, there is all kinds of HyperCard stuff on archive.org.
Well, and this is actually quite recent and very cool that you can actually emulate HyperCard in the browser on archive.org now. So you can actually play these archives they have.
It is a little clunky. Like,
it's pretty clunky.
You have a... I used it, and it's kind of...
Yeah, so you have to wait for it.
You're like, oh, I can't control my computer anymore.
Yeah. So you have to wait for it to boot up this whole emulated like Mac OS System 7, I think, or 6 or 7. It's running. So it boots up this entire little desktop in the browser. And then, yeah, it tries to map your mouse to the virtual mouse and let your keyboard through. And so it is a little clunky. But it works. It runs, which is impressive, because it's hard enough running these in emulation on your own computer these days. So getting it running in a browser is a pretty amazing feat.
Yeah, it's seamless to just go to archive.org and run that, as opposed to getting Basilisk or something.
It's a lot of work to make it work on
the operating system and the BIOS and everything.
Yeah. It's really fiddly. So it's very nice having something that's not fiddly where you can just run it.
And if you know where to look, try BMUG. That's what, Boston Mac User Group HyperCard Stacks?
On archive.org.
Yeah. Just look for HyperCard on archive.org.
Yeah,
you'll find all kinds of stuff. And there are dozens and dozens of applications, including games. And I tried out a few of these. It was kind of frustrating because, you know, you are doing like the emulation in a browser thing, and it's still not fully baked, but it's cool that you
can
at
mostly
least,
work. Yeah,
there's yeah, a few like things it, that don't. It works. It's just not a great experience yet.
But. Yeah, I was going to. So, and it turns out one of my games is actually up there.
Which one is that?
So it's Mr. Lane's Adventure, which was my top-down adventure engine, and it was a project I did for a chemistry class in high school. Mr. Lane was my chem teacher. but it's actually kind of cool. I booted it up enough to see that it basically runs. I haven't played through the whole thing, so no promises. And the sound doesn't work, unfortunately, which because it had some cool sounds in there, but oh well. But yeah, if you're at the archive.org BMUG HyperCard Stacks, I think if you just search it for Mr. Lane, L-A-N-E, it will come up. And yeah, it's got some instructions in there. It's a basic, you know, use your arrow keys to move around top-down adventure game. You're basically collecting mystery elements, and then you have to take them back to the lab where you can do experiments on them and try to guess what they are, and that's the educational part.
Wow, it's like... And then the chemistry roguelike.
it kind of is. I mean, it's not roguelike because it's not actually random. It's not actually randomized. Oh, okay. But then once you've identified some elements, you actually have to use these elements to get past like monsters that are on the map blocking your way. So you find some element that like reacts with the monster or that you can use against it in some way. And then you move on to another screen and so on. So
it's periodic table Oregon Trail.
Or periodic table Zelda. Yeah, sure, I don't know.
Yeah. Grumble, I need beryllium.
But yeah, I was actually pretty proud of it because it's kind of impressive in that it, you know, it looks like a top-down adventure game rather than a HyperCard stack.
Yeah, I poked around and found some weird stuff. Like I found a reasonably well-working Space Invaders clone. I can't remember what it's called, but
that's interesting.
You can move a cursor back and forth at the bottom of the screen, and it's not like a full game.
Is it real time?
It is real time, okay. But there are like invaders that move around at the top of the screen, and you fire a bullet and it moves up really slowly. And basically you can set how many times the invaders will go back and forth across the screen. It recommends doing no more than three. So it's kind of like a test to see how many invaders you can shoot down within three right cycles.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not exactly the real Space Invaders. No one's going to be like, well, you know, I was thinking about picking up, you know, Space Invaders Extreme or Space Invaders versus Arkanoid, but I think I'm just going to go to BMUG's archives on archive.org and play this HyperStack simulation of Space
Invaders. Yeah, and so I'm sure, I haven't seen that one, but I'm sure behind the scenes that's someone doing what I was just talking about where, you know, your bullet is a button that's being told to take up the screen.
Actually, I think it was... It's the letter E.
They're doing it in a text field then. Oh, that's interesting. That's another way to do it. Okay. Yeah. And again, these are things that really wasn't designed for. And at some point you get to where it's just, it's really slow and clunky and not what you want to be doing. But
it wasn't on archive.org. But the most impressive thing I saw by far is a video. I linked to it. I don't know if you checked this out. I just wrote, "This is nuts," which doesn't really explain anything. But it's a video someone recorded of, I guess, like a class project they created where they turned Metal Gear Solid into a HyperCard stack. And it's not, you know, full. It's,
I mean, they made it,
it's
a
not
point
the full Metal Gear Solid, but it's kind of like it. I would say it's almost like a fancier version of a Tiger handheld.
Well, they made it into a point and click adventure, basically.
Sort of.
So you're moving around, picking stuff up, using it on the guards, yada, yada.
But they apparently scanned Yuji Ishikawa's character artwork and they turned it into, you know, one bit black and white. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like they recorded audio off the game.
Yep.
And, you know, have sound effects. So there's like voiceover when you receive transmissions and text.
Yep.
I mean, it's kind of a mess, sure, but it's really interesting that, you know, you have this very simplistic simulation of Shadow Moses Island. You can like move left or right. You come up against a guard and you can either like choke the guard or throw a smoke grenade at them if you found a smoke grenade. I didn't check to see just how far that went, because after, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, I was like, okay, I've seen this pony's trick. But it's still kind of amazing that someone could create so complex and so ambitious a HyperCard stack. Like, I would not have guessed, if it weren't black and white, I probably wouldn't have guessed that was made with HyperCard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this one's made it up on archive.org, but I did a full adventure game, full point and click adventure. Also, I called the Quest for the Golden Orb. It was the most generic name for an adventure game ever. The whole thing was pretty tropey, but it was a whole, you know, I drew out Zork style maps for it, and then made the whole graphical adventure. It probably had like 100 locations or something. So, and that was one, yeah, like I said, that was one of the things that was actually pretty straightforward to do with the tools available and actually worked really well, you know, as opposed to trying to do Space Invaders. A point and click adventure is a thing that really works in this environment. And there's some other things too. If you want actual like good playable games in HyperCard, I mean, a lot of people did card games, gambling games. So you know, you can get perfectly serviceable, you know, hearts or roulette or blackjack and all that sort of things. People did in HyperCard, and you know, there's no reason those don't work as well as in any other system, because you know, you're not trying to do graphics zipping around the screen or anything.
Yeah, I feel like HyperCard gaming and it kind of is impressive on the same level as, you know, like super early microcomputer gaming, like, you know, ZX80 or something. You're just like, wow, this isn't really that fun, but it's amazing that they could do this much with so little. I'm actually kind of interested in some of the projects you listed. A CS demo. Okay. An AI that learned to play Puyo Puyo. Tell me about that. This HyperCard stack might actually be smarter than me.
this was a neural networks project in college. And so, yeah, we simulated Puyo Puyo. I actually had a guy I was doing the group work with simulated Puyo Puyo, and he actually did that in a different language. But I had this neural network learning to play it, and it would basically just, so, okay, crash course in neural nets. You basically have, a set of rules that are just kind of doing random things as inputs to something, and you see what the results are, and you basically score the results on whether they're good or bad. And then you basically mutate the rules, so it tries different things. And you go through a bunch of generations. Actually, this is also genetic algorithms, bunch of AI keywords in here, but, so basically, it was just playing Puyo Puyo by randomly moving blobs around the screen and seeing whether it won. And over a bunch of generations, this thing actually learned how to do combos. And I think because it was playing against itself, it ended up in this state where the way it would win was by causing a combo so huge it instantly caused the other side to lose. So I'm not sure it would have actually been great against a human that was throwing stuff at it constantly, but playing itself where all it was doing was trying to make combos, it got incredibly good at making really big combos, which was impressive. I didn't really expect it to do as well as it did.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And you did that with the HyperCard stack.
I did the actual, yeah. Just because, I ended up doing a lot of things in HyperCard just because it was so, I mean, at that point I already knew it, but you know, it's just super easy to get into. You don't have to worry about things like how do I draw a thing on the screen or how do I get my main loop up and running or whatever that you do in a lot of other languages. Like the framework is all there and incredibly easy.
Well, I knew we were going to talk about HyperCard gaming, but I didn't realize it was going to be also HyperCard playing games.
Yeah,
I didn't realize it was so versatile.
Outside the norm. Well, again, you know, it's a full-featured language, so you can basically do anything with it. You can do in, you know, any other language, like C or whatever. So
is there anything else you want to say about HyperCard itself, or should we move along to HyperCard's magnum opus?
Pretty much covered most of it at this point. Yeah, I mean, there's also, you know, it's also good for messing with graphics. I had a bunch of little things that would just, like, draw their own, like, graphics routines doing fractals or doing random graphics, just because it also had, you know, all the tools you had in MacPaint were also in HyperCard, mostly. Mm-hmm. And you could script them with the scripting language. So it had things that would just, like, stacks that would, like, draw their own things on the screen, like script-generated content. So that was kind of something else that didn't take off for a long time. Now you have, you know, things that will like populate a world with its own trees or stuff, but which is not a thing back then. But you could sort of see the beginnings of that sort of thing in terms of scriptable content.
Well, I'm sure that the folks at Cyan would have appreciated having a HyperCard to create trees. I remember that was one of the big.
I wasn't doing 3D trees at that point. Yeah,
in the game Myst, but we'll take a quick break and then come back and talk about Myst, because that is sort of where HyperCard ultimately led to.
Thank you.
right, so that was HyperCard. Now to talk about HyperCard's proudest baby.
Yes.
Greatest child. Before we do that, though, some people did write in this episode to talk about their memories of both HyperCard and Myst. So you're not the only one up there who made video games in HyperCard.
There were a few of us.
Yeah. Here's a letter from Brad Halverson. I was around 11 or 12 when I first started fumbling around with HyperCard and my Macintosh 2SI, but it wasn't until my family embraced the wild frontier of America Online that I really saw its potential. There were plenty of freeware Mac games available to download, but their quality was too inconsistent to justify spending too much time squeezing them through a 2400 baud modem while getting charged by the minute for the privilege. However, the HyperCard section of early AOL was a treasure trove of homemade creations that were comparatively small, and as a fan of anything that resembled an adventure game, their lo-fi choose-your-own-adventure-style approach really appealed to me. And while the quality was all over the place, there was an uncurated public-access TV quality to these things that I found fascinating. I tried making my own creations, but adolescent me lacked the skill and patience to craft anything terribly compelling. I took some vague stabs at making simple adventure games, and even once tried to make a graphical version of Zork, but the limitations of the software and my own talent meant this project was short-lived. My greatest HyperCard achievement was making a brief choose-your-own-adventure game starring one of my friends, in which you clicked his disrespectfully rendered avatar through a day at school, where, regardless of your choices, he continually failed at everything and was a huge disappointment.
Nice.
I then saved the slanderous HyperCard stack onto a floppy and installed it onto the Mac Classic he was assigned to in computer class so that he'd see it when he went to open the typing tutor program. If this sounds like I used HyperCard to invent cyberbullying, rest assured that it was all safely within the realm of gently antagonistic camaraderie of schoolyard chums. We're still friends to this day despite our mutually inflicted childhood cruelty.
That is fantastic.
Is amazing.
I love it.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, adventure games were definitely one of the biggest genres you got out of HyperCard, just because it was so geared towards that sort of point and click kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have HyperCard back then because my dad had Prodigy, so there wasn't quite as much that I got online. I got most of mine on discs. But
all right. To avoid this being just like half an hour of my voice, why don't you read the next letter?
Oh, geez.
We can just pass it back and forth.
Okay, my first time, go easy on me. Okay, so we have a letter from Rory Starks. And he says, my introduction to HyperCard was the full version of the software that was included with Cheyenne's Spelunks in the Caves of Mr. Pseudo for the Macintosh. Yes, so this is what we're about to get into. It was treated almost like a plugin that you needed to install before running the game. I understood that it was used to make Spelunks, and I wanted to make my own games if possible. I found several books at my local library that contained documentation and tutorials on authoring stacks. The most memorable one was The Complete HyperCard 2.2 Handbook by Danny Goodman. Yes, that was a good one. I borrowed that book so many times that the library eventually let me keep it.
Wow.
I also spent a lot of time dissecting HyperCard games that were distributed on AOL. One of the best parts of HyperCard was how easy it was to see how other people made their own stacks. It was a really fun way to learn about software development. I made a slew of poorly drawn point-and-click adventure games and arcade games with all that I had learned. HyperCard had a huge impact on my life as I eventually worked in the game industry as a user interface designer and developer. So yeah, definitely. I have that book. It's a good book. And that's actually a good point he brings up. Using HyperCard as a programming learning tool was a really good thing, because like I said, you know, you just had these relatively readable scripts that was the language. And it was possible to lock a stack before distributing it, so you couldn't get into the scripts. But a lot of people didn't bother doing that. And even if it was locked, there were some ways you could get around it usually. And so yeah, it was a really good tool. You saw someone doing a neat thing, a lot of the time you could just go into the script and see what they were doing.
Here's a long one from Ravi Kanodia. I don't know if I have any special insight into HyperCard, but I do have a lot of fond memories of it, both as a user of HyperCard stacks and as a creator. In the late 80s and early 90s, I was part of a cadre of friends at an affluent elementary school that spent a great deal of time developing little games using HyperCard, both at our school and at home on our personal computers, which in hindsight was a lot bigger deal than I understood at the time. The work was slow going because none of us had any real knowledge of programming or computer science. We did have a HyperCard reference manual, a thick book containing a list of every function built into HyperCard, with brief descriptions of what they did, but no books which taught anything about the fundamentals of programming or the specifics of HyperCard semantics. It was sort of like trying to learn Japanese with just a Japanese-English dictionary, and nothing to teach the sentence structure or verb conjugation. Because of that, all of our programs were riddled with bugs and design choices that would make a junior developer's eyes pop out of his skull. Because we had no idea what source control was, let alone a way to use it, we could only collaborate by passing around copies of our stacks on 3.5-inch floppies. If two of us had been working on the same stack, unbeknownst to each other, the only way to resolve the discrepancy was to open one of the versions in an editor and type the changes from the other version in manually. Almost all of the changes we made were shamelessly cribbed from popular titles, approximated as closely as we could manage with what little knowledge we had. For instance, one of my projects was a top-down RPG with grid-based overworld movement, which largely worked, and a Dragon Warrior-inspired battle screen, which largely didn't. My most complete project was the unimaginatively titled Wizard Tale, a simple two-dimensional first-person labyrinth, again all drawn in Mac Paint, that the player had to escape by navigating with the arrow keys and collecting a set of items by clicking on them. Some of the items were keys and others were weapons, allowing the player to defeat monsters, which were effectively obstacles blocking the player's progress. One of my friends started our most ambitious game, a Street Fighter knockoff starring ourselves as the playable characters, all drawn in Mac Paint, by the way. We used HyperCard's text console as the input buffer. Every half second or so, the stack would look at whatever had been typed into the console and compare it to a long list of move commands.
Nice.
If we found a match, a simple animation would play and one character would take damage. For instance, typing 214P would make the right character throw a fireball. It didn't work very well because both players were typing on the same keyboard into the same input field, and we didn't know enough to be able to parse out the characters from each player separately. If the other player typed anything while you were doing a move, it wouldn't happen. In order to play it at all, the two players effectively had to agree to take turns. Another friend didn't use HyperCard to make games, but rather animations, in a process which we would now consider to be roughly analogous to Flash cartoons. The content of these animations was usually bizarre and disturbing, and he got sent to the principal's office more than once for presenting such brilliant works as Happy Family Barbecue, wherein a suburban family accidentally cooks themselves alive on a Weber grill. In retrospect, it's kind of a miracle no one ever called Child Protective Services on his family. After elementary school, our weird little band of nerds fragmented for various reasons, and HyperCard quickly faded into our past without ever really being replaced. With the exception of one member of the group that I've since lost contact with, none of us ended up following a career in game development. But all of us grew up to be well-adjusted and productive members of society in some way or another, even the guy who made Happy Family Barbecue. Many of us work in tech, including one friend whose early background in programming, largely gleaned from those HyperCard years, has occasionally allowed him to outshine his peers and advance his career in an otherwise non-development-related role. As for myself, I bounced around Silicon Valley as a developer of various stripes for more than a decade. None of that time was in the games industry until just recently, when my career path led me to an engineering role on Sony's PlayStation team. So who knows, maybe someday Wizard Tale will be coming to a PlayStation near you.
Nice. It's always good to hear people doing things as weird as I was. Actually, at one point I was pretty convinced I could recreate most of Final Fantasy 1 in HyperCard, and I think I probably could have done it, but I kind of lost interest, although the map code that I made for that is what ended up being in the top-down adventure that I actually did make.
So. I mean, Final Fantasy 1 was a pretty big game.
I don't mean in terms of all the content. Oh, I mean, okay. Like, I'm not going to draw all those monsters myself, but in terms of the engine and the mechanics, I think it's pretty doable.
You might even have come up with some spells that, like Temper, that work.
That actually work? Yeah, maybe. One is from Brian Rude, who says, I originally learned some basic HyperCard techniques on my school's black and white Macs, just enough to make some simple animations. When the school got a whopping 2-color Macs a couple of years later, I taught what I knew to a couple of my friends who were in the same class, and we would use our free time to create adventure games. Mine was essentially a choose-your-own-adventure game with the occasional hidden secret that focused on humor. My friends teamed up to make a game that ended up being more like 1988's The Manhole, which we're also about to talk about, in that there were no particular goals and a secret in nearly every object in the relatively small environment. Both of our games came to an unceremonious end when they reached the limits of our respective max memory. I wanted to save them, but they were far too big for a single floppy, and the teacher wouldn't let me install a program to split files onto multiple disks. Ah, so sad.
That's pretty harsh.
That's kind of tragic.
That is a weird facet of video games from a long time ago.
Splitting over disks.
Yeah.
And you did have to find something that would do that, because you couldn't just, you know, take a single file and drag it onto multiple floppies.
Yep. Let's see, from Matt Lichtenberg. I didn't have a lot of experience with HyperCard when it was new, other than exploring the manhole and Cosmic Osmo whenever I came across them, but I've been having some fun exploring the Internet Archive's recent edition of more than 3,000 HyperCard stacks, all playable in browser. Okay, I didn't realize it was that many stacks. So, yeah, go to archive.org and look up HyperCard, and you will never lack for primitive database-driven video games ever again. Yeah. Thad Boyd writes, there's a straight line between HyperCard and what I do for a living and for a hobby today. HyperCard was my first development environment. I was 7 or 8 years old and I wanted to make games. Today we've got Kodu and Super Mario Maker. In 1990, we had HyperCard. HyperCard's interface bore a certain resemblance to PowerPoint with drawing tools that looked a lot like Mac Paint. You could show slides or cards in order, as in PowerPoint, but you can also use buttons to link out to cards out of order. So it was a useful language for making your own choose-your-adventure games. If you wanted to examine the sound coming from the next room, turn to page 38. If you want to see what's going on outside, turn to page 44. That kind of thing, but with buttons to click. My game, Seeker's Awesome Adventures, was mostly that sort of thing. There were a few roundabout ways to get where you were going, some of which would result in your untimely death. The most complex sequence involved selecting two tools from a list that you'd be allowed to use later on, and keeping track of your selection required just a bit of actual programming. I mostly built Seeker through the simple point-and-click front end, but HyperCard also came with its own programming language, HyperTalk. I used HyperTalk to track what weapons and tools the user selected, and the endgame would adjust accordingly. You're in a pit? Did you bring the grappling hook? It's pitch black. Did you bring the night vision goggles? Store a variable and test a conditional. This is absolutely as simple as programming gets. It was a pretty good place to start. And that's more or less how the web works. Fundamentally, it's a set of pages, and users navigate between them using hyperlinks. For more complicated stuff than just moving between pages, your browser has built-in support for scripting languages. The similarities aren't coincidental. The HyperCard Wikipedia entry says that, through its influence on Robert Callalou, HyperCard influenced the development of the web in late 1990. Yep. JavaScript was inspired by HyperTalk. HyperCard is where I started programming, and while I never did make a career of game development, I'm still programming, and there's a more than passing resemblance between developing for HyperCard and developing for the web. My grandmother's been clearing old stuff out of her house, and a few weeks ago, she gave me a bunch of old 3.5-inch floppies. Seeker's Awesome Adventures is probably in there somewhere. The original graphical HyperCard version, the text-only remake I put together in QBasic a few years later, and maybe even the unfinished Turbo Pascal port with PC speaker music. I really should buy a USB floppy drive and see if I can get any data off those disks. All right. And finally, from Superboy Allen, one last letter on HyperCard.
Boy Allen says, when my parents upgraded from our old Apple IIgs to a compact Presario 7170 with its blazing 90 megahertz processor and massive 840 megabyte hard drive, I had some of my first experiences with CD-ROM technology. Sierra's Lolo-esque edutainment puzzler Spelling Jungle, adventure titles like King's Quest VII, and Patrick Stewart's inimitable voice work in Computron Interactive's Encyclopedia 1995. Yes, that last one is totally a real thing. Sounds good. Anyway, King's Quest VII was my inroad into the adventure genre, and Myst followed relatively soon after. I didn't have a bunch of baggage with the genre. I wasn't savvy to the Walking Dead scenarios and obtuse puzzle solving of earlier titles, and the departure from an inventory-based system, while noticeable, didn't turn me off to the genre. I know I had to look some things up, but I had a good time. I lost touch with the series after buying Riven, though. Maybe it was the inclusion of all those other characters you interact with in person, or maybe it was that I got sick of having to constantly switch between 5 CDs as I travel between areas. Maybe now that I have it on GOG, I'll give it another try without that technological burden being in my way. I get the sense that the experience of the first game could never be fully recaptured by the original developers, though. Sure, other games have done the you're in a world and you have to figure everything out thing, but like John Cage's famous or infamous music composition 433, in which the performers remain silent throughout the entire work, maybe it was the sort of thing you could only really create once. The magic of the game was in its immersion. It was an experience where the developers left the players to their own devices, telling you, in Patrick Stewart's words, go, explore, and enjoy. The adventure is yours.
Yeah, I definitely share Alan's frustration with Riven, and that seems like a great transition, a great what do you call it? Yes, transition.
Segue.
To segue, that's what they're called. Yes. One of those things you ride around on.
Yeah.
A great segue into talking about Myst, the crowning achievement of HyperCard, although kind of not really.
To get to Myst, we start with the manhole, maybe.
Okay. So I guess we start with Cyan.
Cyan,
which
yes.
Which is now called Cyan Worlds, a company established by two brothers, Rand and Robin Miller.
Yep.
And they were kind of focused on using HyperCard for creating educational game-like applications.
Yeah, so they, like a lot of us, didn't really have a programming background. They hadn't done games before, but this was something they wanted to get into, and HyperCard made it really easy. So the manhole is exactly the kind of thing we've been talking about that is the sort of genre of game that HyperCard is best suited to. It's a point-and-click adventure where you're going between various scenes and interacting with things. And unlike Myst that came later, Manhole really looks like a HyperCard thing, mm-hmm. in that it's all detailed black-and-white pixel graphics of the kind that early Mac made famous.
I never actually saw that version. By the time, if I'm thinking correctly, maybe I'm thinking of Cosmic Osmo.
Cosmic Osmo is very similar.
Did they remake one of these games in color?
They've all been remade.
Okay, yeah.
They've all been remade since then, yeah.
It on CD-ROM, and it was
Was a later version. But so the original of both Manhole and Cosmic Osmo was this detailed 1-bit art. Very distinctive look to it, like a lot of other early Mac games. And it was very much just, so Manhole was really just kind of a toy box. It wasn't even particularly educational other than, you know, teaching kids to explore and use the computer and click around on things. But it was just, this fairy tale inspired world that you could just explore. And there was really no goal and there was really no end game. It's just click on things and cool stuff happens and you can navigate around. And it had a few characters that you would run into multiple times and they would maybe go somewhere else after you interact with them. So there were a few little through stories, but nothing really overall coherent. It's just look at these cool things. And a lot of early HyperCard stuff was like that. Look at these cool things I made. It did have sound and some voice work. Anyone who's played the original version would be like, oh my, there's a tiny boat in my teacup. And it had some very like quotable little lines. But it was just kind of a fun place to spend time, a toy box to kind of poke around at.
But not really a game so much, as you say.
Yeah, it was just sort of an experience. And honestly, I feel like maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here. But both this and Myst were sort of, in some ways, precursors to the sort of reinvented genre that we now call a walking simulator, mm-hmm. which was not really a thing so much at the time. You know, you had your adventure games that were very goal-focused and had inventories and were all about the puzzles. But both the Manhole and later Myst were much more about putting you in an environment and letting you just explore. And it's something that I think has had a resurgence recently. You know, we have this whole subgenre of walk-in simulator that's going around and just kind of figuring stuff out on your own, mm-hmm. with as little interface as possible between you and the environment. And that was very much their ethos here, is mm-hmm. strip away everything so it's just you and an interesting environment.
Then, as now, hardcore gamers right. were adamant that these aren't real
games. Like, where's the actual game
trash.
System? Yeah.
And, you know, as kind of like to fly in the face of that, again, Myst was the single most successful PC game ever until The Sims came along.
Yeah.
And The Sims is also sort of like that little fart around in a toy box, what's the actual game here kind of experience. So yeah, it's almost like a lot of people really enjoy that, and gatekeeping video games is stupid, and you shouldn't do it.
It's sort of the ultimate in accessibility. Like there barely are any systems. There's nothing you have to know. You just drop in and go.
Right. So Myst, you know, we've been talking about HyperCard, and Myst is very much limited by sort of what you can do with HyperCard. I know the Millers wanted to create like a fully immersive 3D world, but the technology wasn't really there. I mean, this was, the game launched in 1993.
Yeah.
So, you know, 3D games at the time, there were some, but I mean, this was the same time Doom was launching.
Right. So
that wasn't even really 3D. That was just, you know,
it was fake 3D.
Yeah. Like projections on a 2D yeah. space.
So this was a time when there were rendering engines there where you could make really convincing looking environments, but it would take an hour to render that frame. Right. So you could make something really cool and complex that looked almost, I mean, okay, today it doesn't look like a real space, but for the time you were like,
yeah, I went back,
oh
and
my God, this was so
Myst
real
for this, or, you know, messed around in Myst for a little while. And I'm like, this does not look as amazing as it
does
did
not
in
look as impressive anymore. But for the time, and again, compared to things like Doom, which were these little pixely things and flat planes, and that was it, because that was what you could do if you were trying to render something in real time. If you went into a rendering engine and gave it an hour to render something, you could make this really impressive looking 3D scene. But again, you know, hours to render a frame. So you're not going to be doing that on someone's personal computer, letting them walk around. So, like Final Fantasy VII did, you pre-render mm-hmm. these cool scenes and then you present
or
them.
Donkey Kong Country, which was more
Donkey
contemporary
Country, yeah.
with Myst, that came out less than a year later.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, it was a different kind of game, but the idea was there of using 3D mm-hmm. objects and pre-rendering them in advance and then taking those images and turning them into video game, you know, like yeah. more traditional game structure. So where Donkey Kong Country was about taking pre-rendered graphics and making them backgrounds and, you know, animated sprites, mm-hmm. Myst was about taking those pre-rendered images, those scenes, and turning them into, you know, different perspectives in a first-person adventure image. Yeah. I mean, it was like taking, you know, Shadowgate, which also started on Macintosh,
yeah.
And making it much more, quote-unquote, realistic, much more immersive. The thing about these 3D spaces that they created is that once they had created the spaces, once they had built the environments, then they could just place a camera in different
right.
directions,
render
different angles,
different places.
And yeah, give you lots of different viewpoints of the island. So all of a sudden, instead of having like, you know, 30 different scenes as you would in a game like Monkey Island, you had all these different spaces with dozens and dozens of perspectives.
Yeah, going forward and backward through various paths.
Yeah, so, you know, it wasn't as immersive as real-time 3D where you'd, you know, turn and rotate and everything would spin around you. But they approached that by using this node system where if you clicked on the side of the screen, your perspective would change. Sometimes you turn all the way around, but sometimes you turn like 5 degrees and look at, you know, something a little more specifically, a little more mm-hmm. particularly, and change your focus.
And so this fit very well with the default HyperCard paradigm, in that you've got a bunch of scenes which are equivalent to a bunch of cards, and you're just replacing the built-in 1-bit graphics with these gorgeously rendered scenes. So structurally, it's very much like the manhole where you're just clicking from place to place. It's just that now it looks like you're in this amazing 3D environment instead of looking at this black and white 2D storybook. Mm-hmm.
Myst also greatly simplified how the game worked. You know, the adventure genre to this point, you had LucasArts games and you had Sierra games, yeah. and those were kind of the big dogs. There were lots of other people making adventure games, but they were kind of fading out around this time and sort of taking, you know, fading into the background. LucasArts hit it big with Maniac Mansion, but, you know, that and Monkey Island were sort of their big hits, and everything after that was sort of diminishing returns, and Sierra was, you know, they were having trouble with King's Quest and Space Quest, and Police Quest, I think, did pretty well for them around this time. But
it was an established subgenre at that point, and it had its core of fans. So there was still new stuff coming out that the fans were lapping up.
Right.
But I guess it wasn't really drawing in a lot
really
of new
growing.
People at that
and
point.
And then at the same time, again, you know, Myst came out at the same time as Doom. And that was just, you know, that was like the Nirvana of, like, as Nirvana was to rock music, Doom was to video games. It made everyone stop and say, whoa, this is different and new, and the 90s are here.
Yeah.
And Myst took a different approach to the adventure game, the adventure genre, than LucasArts or Sierra had. I mean, it kind of fell in line with the LucasArts style of the ethos of you can't die. It was possible to have a bad outcome and get a bad ending, but that literally came down to the final choice you made in the game. there was no point of no return at which you were like, oh, I should have picked up this thing, you know, 30 minutes into the game, but I forgot. So now I'm 25 hours into this adventure and I'm totally boned.
Yeah, you can't get permanently
stuck.
There's
none of that.
There's no nothing that can stay you permanently. There's no enemies. There's no systems. Like, I think the primary driving thing here for them was to be as immersive as possible. And to that end, they wanted to, as I mentioned, they basically wanted to strip away all of the, and they want no interface. It's just between you and nothing between you and the world. So you're just here. There's no menus. There's not even an inventory.
Yeah, a big part of that is taking away the inventory. To me, that is the biggest, like, this is different approach to games. You didn't have, you know, the LucasArts, like, click on the text and, you know, you have sort of the smart sentences that create, and you didn't have a menu full of items. You could hold one item at a time.
I think one of the reasons they went to that is because at the time, there wasn't really an immersive way to do that that didn't involve cutting away to a menu or having a menu take up a part of the screen. Like, you're right, because we weren't rendering this in real-time 3D, so you couldn't just have, like, a satchel that you look into that's still immersive in the world. You would have to have it in a menu. And they didn't want that. They wanted it to just be the screen of you in the world. And so that was the result, is that you had, you know, you had your hands and you had your perspective, and that was it.
Well, you didn't even see your hands. It wasn't like Trespasser.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, you would have a cursor.
Right. Yeah, like a hand icon, but, basically.
Yeah.
And if you were holding something, then you would see the icon would follow you around and it would change. But that was it.
Yep.
And you saw the same philosophy a decade later, almost, with Halo, where you didn't have the ability to carry 10 or 20 weapons where you'd, like, hit the function key to change your weapon.
But you just had one or two.
What you could hold in one hand and what you could hold in the other hand, and your grenades. And that was it. And I think that's a big part of those games' appeal. Like, they simplify things. And, you know, it creates interesting gameplay dynamics. Like, it's not just, oh, this is, you know, a simplified game and there's less to do. It's a matter of, like, you have to make choices. Like, which item do I want to carry around the island? I have the ability to carry one item, but there's two in this space. So what do I need right now? Just like in Halo, you're like, well, I could carry, you know, like a Covenant weapon and the pistol, but I might need to shoot someone at a distance. So do I want to keep the sniper rifle, even though it's extremely limited in use and I can only, you know, fire three rounds from it? You know, it creates these sort of dilemmas that you have to choose and make decisions around.
Yeah, although
I think Myst is a little more forgiving in that regard.
Yeah, there's not really a lot of items even in the game. So there's not usually too much dilemma as to what to do. Like, most of the puzzles are relatively self-contained where they are. Occasionally you have to, occasionally you get something that you want to bring back with you to the hub to use.
I seem to remember there were a couple of times, it's been a while, but I seem to remember there were a couple of times where I would have, you know, like, different items to pick between.
There's a few. But most of the stuff is fairly self-contained in its own areas until you get what you're going for. And then sometimes you will get one of the pages that you're collecting. You'll need to bring that back with you. But other than, you know, you usually don't have, it's usually not, you don't find yourself in a case where you're like, oh, I need this thing and I left it, you know, two worlds away. Mm-hmm.
this is a game that is really about just clearing off the bullshit threshold.
Yeah. I mean, honestly,
of adventure
I think
games.
If it had existed at the time, this game would have been in VR because it was all about just the immersiveness about you being there and not having other stuff in the way and just doing things directly. Mm-hmm. Of course, that wasn't something that existed. But
yeah. And I again, like you said, I feel like I agree with you that this genre has made a comeback. Like, Myst was very controversial at the time because it did simplify so much and people were like, oh, well, it's just like a vacation simulator. Yeah, it's all about the pretty graphics. And it was. Yeah. I mean, these graphics, like, no one had ever seen graphics like this on a computer before as a home product. And this was, I think, the first game that was CD-ROM only because you could not have put all these visuals.
It was the first big one, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't have put all these. I mean, it wasn't the first CD-ROM game, but it might have been the only one, like, the first one that you could only buy on CD because it would have been hundreds and hundreds of floppy disks.
Yeah, and it was, and you read about this as being actually a driver of CD-ROM sales, because, you know, CD-ROMs weren't built into things back then. You had to actually go out and buy one, and people would buy one to play games like this with you know, these amazing graphics.
I bought a 2X CD-ROM and a speaker set in 1994 for my computer, and the first game I bought was Myst. And I didn't regret it. Like the sound effects, you know, the sort of atmospheric mm-hmm. sound, there's a little bit of music and there are some puzzles that are based around sound.
Yep.
But it was, you know, just the atmospheres, the water rippling and lapping as you move closer to the shore. Like there was a lot of spatial thought put into these locations and the sounds that were associated with them, even though this was not a, you know, free moving immersive 3D game.
Yeah, they did their best to give you a sense of where you were. They did the best to give you a sense of where you were in this space mm-hmm. through both the graphics and the sounds. Unlike Manhole, it's not like there weren't actually game elements in here as well. So a lot of it was exploring, but then there's also a ton of puzzle content.
That's pretty much what Myst was.
Yeah, it's puzzles in an environment.
You know, sometimes it's a little on the nose. Like when you first arrive at the island, you're on like the hub island, which I guess is Myst itself.
Yeah.
And it has like an observatory and a pool and, you know, there's a forest, but it's all very small and kind of self-contained. And you can go into some buildings, but eventually you have to go kind of like up the stairs and across the island. And as you do that, there's a note just laying on the ground that the sort of invisible presence whose personality exists throughout the game, Atris, has left a note for his wife saying, like, input the number of things on the island, like, I think...
Switches
on the island into the imager, and I have a message for you. So it's like...
So there's an interesting...
It's a little obvious, like...
I read an interesting thing about, though, that is apparently that note was not originally there, mm-hmm. But they were playtesting people with this game, mm-hmm. and they found that people who were expecting kind of a linear adventure game... They were expecting like some kind of inciting incident to tell them what they're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And they were just kind of flailing around lost without anything like that. And so they actually added that note fairly late in development.
It has that feel about it. I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised to see that. Because when I went back and replayed, I was like, this feels really out of keeping with the rest of the game. I mean, you have notes and stuff around. Like the whole game is based around the concept, the power of words, like literally the power of words. Mm-hmm. You're using a book. You use books to get around
Link
to these
books,
worlds.
Yeah, so that,
and the idea is that the worlds exist within the books because Atris, the author of the books, has used like his magical powers to create these worlds by writing about them. Mm-hmm. So it is a very word-centric concept and universe, which is what makes this note so like really. But
yeah, so
I guess
it was a concession to give people some place to start before they got into the whole idea of, you know, they're just supposed to be exploring and piecing this together.
I guess not every game can be Super Mario Brothers World 1-1.
Yeah,
and teach you on the fly. So aside from that one little like bump, I mean, it is very much just about finding these gears and switches and machines and gizmos and devices and mysteries and figuring out what the hell is happening here.
Yeah, well, so maybe we should give some context to what actually goes on in this game for people who haven't played it. So you find in the hub world, there's these two books that appear to have people trapped in them.
Right.
But
you just start on the shore. Like,
yeah, you start on the shore.
There's
nothing aside from this note that was added in.
Well, there's the very preamble. Like, I touched the Myst book and fell into the world.
Yeah, so you fall into this world through a book. So you know that's a thing. The books contain things. But eventually, you know, you go to the center of this island, you find these two books that seem to have people trapped in them, but the books have pages missing, and that makes the transmissions coming from these people very scratchy, so you can hardly tell anything they're saying. So it becomes pretty obvious that what you want to do is try to get pages to fix these books and figure out what's going on, you know, why people are trapped, what's happened here. And so you find then on the hub island through solving some puzzles, you find other books that take you to other worlds Or they then in turn have their own puzzles that keep you from getting around, and you solve those and you can eventually find pages and bring them back.
Right, because of course it's a video game, and rather than just like taking the pages out of the book, the person putting these people in prison in the books didn't say, okay, I'm just going to burn these pages. They put them very carefully behind
hidden them
in other worlds.
Yeah. Yes, behind puzzles. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, because it is, it, you know, it is a game. It's not just an exploration simulator. There is stuff to do. And there's a lot of stuff to do. There's a ton of puzzles that are all very clever. But they do make a point of not just saying, you know, you walk up and, oh, here's, you know, a crossword puzzle written on the wall or whatever. The puzzles are sort of integrated into the environment. So there's like, you know, there's an age that has lots of mechanical things in it and way to get around. And there's like this monorail system that's kind of broken and you have to figure out how to navigate it. And it turns out that it makes different sounds for different directions. Mm-hmm. And you have to piece together.
That was the one
you're talking about.
Yeah, the sound. Most trouble.
That's a tricky one. You got to write down a lot of stuff to figure that out. But
Everything else I figured out my own. I had to get a handbook for that one.
I think I got that one eventually. But yeah, so it's all these puzzles that are very integrated into just the things that make up the environment. And a lot of, I think for all the other worlds, they've said that actually basically they started with coming up with interesting environmentally based puzzles and then sort of built these worlds around them to make them work naturally.
And the worlds themselves are pretty interesting. They're pretty distinct. Like the Stone Ship era where you have, I guess, like a world that wasn't written well. So it consists of like a rocky island and then there's a giant boat that's like
embedded in it.
Yeah. It's like a teleporter accident in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Like the boat is actually protruding from the rock. So you're like, oh, something bad happened here. But yeah, these worlds are all barren and empty, and there's actually a lot of fiction built up around this game.
There's a ton of backstory over the years.
Yeah. But I think Robin Miller wrote three books, mm-hmm. like three full-size like novels
yeah.
That largely fill in the backstory about Atris, his wife Catherine, the Dani people who, mm-hmm. Or Dunny, who basically created this ability to use language, and Atris's father turns out to be a jackass and his sons are jackasses.
A lot of people are jackasses.
Yeah, basically Atris is a pretty cool dude and his wife's pretty cool. And then everyone around them is horrible.
Yeah, it's one of those families that has family issues.
Yeah,
like in every big adventure, you know,
yes.
like the Skywalkers or the mm-hmm. Mishimas or whatever. Everyone's a jackass.
Yep. But,
because that's how you get plots.
Right. And then but, there were five core games in Myst, as well as Uru, which is kind of where the main creators of Myst went after Myst 2.
Yeah, they did 1 and 2 and then split
and
off.
I didn't play Uru, but apparently there's as much content in that one game because it was like online and they kept adding expansions.
Yeah.
There's as much material in that one game as the Quintology.
Yeah, so I never actually played it myself, but it's certainly an interesting development story. So they split off and let Ubisoft actually for a while was publishing the core Myst games while Rand and Robin working on. They wanted to do this online collaborative version, which unfortunately, again, kind of was ahead of its time in some ways and didn't work out so well. So they had this sort of frame story where in order to have a lot of people doing this, it was like a modern day archaeology expedition uncovering the ancient Dani civilization and figuring out its secrets. So you could design your own avatar instead of being part of this plot. And you're all just, you know, archaeologists working on this. And it was supposed to be this grand multiplayer online thing where you could collaborate with people with puzzles and stuff. But there were a lot of issues and the multiplayer stuff didn't work very well. And so eventually it got released as a single player game, which was supposed to have a multiplayer component coming, but it got delayed and then it got canceled. And then like years later, who was it? GameTap resurrected
mm-hmm. That's
it. Right. And so that's when it actually existed as a commercial product briefly for like a year, but it didn't have enough subscribers. So it got shut down again. And then they got the rights back and eventually they open sourced it. So it's still out there. It has like a fan community, I think, that keeps it running. But yeah, it didn't get a lot of chance to exist as a real product.
Yeah. And so Myst 3 and 4 were developed. 3 was by Presto Studios, the creators of the Journeyman
project. Guys. Yep.
And then 4 was developed internally by Ubisoft once Ubisoft bought the rights to Myst from Broderbund.
So that was actually Ubisopht Montreal. I didn't know that until I looked it up recently, that they actually
did
Myst 4.
It's weird.
Yeah.
And then Myst 5, End of Ages, was developed by Cyan
World. That was back to Cyan, yeah.
And about a week before it came out, they laid off like everyone at the studio.
Yeah, but
and
then they hired them back.
Pretty much, cause, yeah.
Because they got some funding from someone.
Yeah, and so Cyan World is still around. And I interviewed Robin Miller a few years back at GDC. Yeah. And like he's definitely a writer. Like you can tell. Like he's very, very thoughtful.
But so Rand, meanwhile, came back and did a Kickstarter game just a few years ago.
Abduction.
Abduction, yeah. So this, I actually sort of lost track of this. I remember when it came out being pretty excited about it. But he decided, you know, he wanted to do another sort of Myst-like exploration and puzzles game, and he did a Kickstarter in 2013, which did not amazingly, but well enough to proceed. Or in 2013, yeah, it was the Kickstarter, and then it came out
last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've heard good things about it.
Actually, I haven't played it, but I probably should.
I haven't
either.
Yeah.
But and it's out on PS4 now, too, because they did a PSVR version, and it came out on PS4
I think
also.
It kind of got overshadowed by The Witness, which was very much the same sort of thing, except everyone I know who's played The Witness says it's really smug.
Mm.
Whereas Abduction, I feel, is more just like a... Have your own adventure. Do your own thing.
Yeah. So it's not in the Myst continuity. It's just sort of a similar feel. Like the gimmick in Abduction is that bits of Earth have basically been teleported to this alien world. So you have this mixture of human and alien architecture together. And yeah, it sounds like a fun environment for puzzles and things. I should probably check it out sometime.
Talk more about sort of the evolution of Myst, but honestly, there's not that much to
It stayed very similar through the first three or four titles. Like,
yeah.
There were a few things added. They added at some point the ability to take notes and screenshots in game. So you could basically, you know, the first games, and we talked about this in the micro episode, which I don't know if it's aired at the time this one airs.
Yeah.
But okay, the micro episode where we talked about gaming early at home in the 90s and how you know, didn't have game facts, so you had to take your own notes to figure stuff out. And the first few Mysts were very much required
that.
It came with an empty notebook for you to take notes in. Eventually, as technology progressed, they decided maybe people would want to do this in the game itself. And so the later ones have a journal that you can take your notes within the game, and you can take screenshots and bring them with you so you can refer back to them. And that was really about the only progress, aside from, you know, having a little bit more video, a little more character interaction.
Yeah, I mean, Riven, the sequel to Myst, took like 3 years to produce, or maybe longer.
I think
it was more
like
4 or 5. And that came out on 5 CD-ROMs.
That
killed it for me, because you're constantly switching back and forth. It was very inelegant. Like, they needed DVD-ROM at that point.
Yeah.
DVDs didn't exist until 1998, so it was a little too late. That even came out on
DVD.
PlayStation. So it was like, I think it was 6 discs on PS1. But it was just too many. Like, anytime you switched worlds or whatever, then you had to switch discs. And this was a much more complex game than Myst in terms of traveling between spaces.
Yeah.
So you were switching discs a lot. And it just, I don't know, like, that was really irritating.
It was a problem for this kind of
game. It wasn't like Final Fantasy VII, where you get to, you know, the end of disc one and that's it. You're done with disc one. This game, you'd keep putting.
Yeah, because one of the things about these games is you can go wherever you want, so that you can't kind of linearize it like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't until Myst 4, I think, was the first one that actually came out on DVD, mm-hmm. and then finally had
yeah,
the space
to
do it.
I didn't even play Myst 3, but then I played Myst 4 and reviewed it for 1UP.com.
Oh, did you?
And
I haven't actually
really
played a lot of that.
I was surprised by it. Like, I thought, oh, you know, I got the assignment, it was like, I don't really want to do this, but then I played it and really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. And then Myst 5 actually did give you finally real-time immersive visuals. I mean, they used the Uru engine for it.
Yeah.
Not Uru. Was Uru real-time? They did
Uru
real
was
Myst.
In 3D. Yeah,
okay, they did real Myst.
Both real Myst and Uru in 3D.
Okay.
Uru was definitely 3D because Uru had your own avatar. So Uru was actually third person, unlike all the others, which are first person. Uru was third person, so you could see your multiplayer avatar. So they had the engine at that point, and then Myst 5 was done completely in 3D. Although, interestingly, they had this like option where you could navigate around it in real time, like a 3D, just walk wherever you want, or you could switch to back to node-based and have it be like the old games where you click from point to point if that's what you want to do.
So yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all there is to say about Myst. It seems like the story kind of wrapped itself up. The third game introduced Atrus's daughter.
Yeah.
And she played a bigger role in 4, which kind of brought an end to the brothers' story, Cirrus and Akinar, who are the two kids, the two dudes in the trapped in the prison books in the first game.
Yep.
Like their stories wrap up. One of them turns out to be an okay guy in the end, and the other is a monster.
Which is kind of a weird retcon, really, but I mean,
I think he makes, you know, penance.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all very Christian. And then 5 involves the daughter, and I actually don't remember what happened in the story in any of them beyond the first one, but
yeah,
it got
a little melodramatic about halfway through the 5 game arc because you sort of, it has the same thing any ongoing saga where you have to keep kind of one-upping yourself in terms of dramatic developments, but they did pretty much wrap it up and had a full saga of this family.
Yeah, as with a lot of properties that find their way to companies like Ubisoft, I'm pretty sure it's done. They bought the rights to it. They published a few games and said, all right, that's it. The end. So we'll probably never see another Myst game. Certainly.
It's pretty wrapped up. So yeah, I think it's at a good
place. Cyan is onto its own projects now. But
I don't know if Rand's working on something else now that Abduction is pretty much out on all the platforms it was aiming for. Mm. That'd be interesting to know, but I don't know what he's
working on the Switch port now.
Possibly, yeah. Originally, it was just like PC and Oculus, and then it came out on PlayStation and a few other things.
So before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you for your perspective on Myst as a HyperCard game. We touched on that just a little bit, but I want to kind of round this up. You know, as someone who used HyperCard and programmed for HyperCard a lot, can you talk about like what this game does with HyperCard and where it kind of fudges things?
I mean, it's actually, so in a lot of ways, it's pretty prototypical as a HyperCard adventure game in that you're just, you know, you're clicking between scenes. So you're going from card to card, even though it's kind of obscured. You don't think of them as cards at that point, of course. You think of it as moving through this 3D area, but behind the scenes, you're going from one node to the next in this stack. And so it's very typical in that way. And there's a few things that have interactivity, but it's pretty minimal. You know, you click on this invisible button and then it causes some change in the world or you get an object or whatever. And that's all pretty straightforward. So really the main thing it did was just make huge leverage of these external add-ons that allowed them to do full color, full screen graphics and add in little movie clips that they integrate. And it was actually, I mean, a lot of the innovation there was they did some very clever things to enable the presentation that they had. So they had like little tiny, and again, to get this to all fit on a few CDs, they would have these like little tiny super compressed QuickTime movies of something being animated, like birds flying or butterflies or reshaking something that they would have created, or in fact, real characters that were filmed, but that they created green screened and then perfectly integrated into the pre-rendered 3D background. So you had this illusion that you had this beautiful world that had living elements in it when it was, you know, this one big static picture with a very clever movie overlaid onto one little tiny part of it.
I had forgotten all about that until I got to replay it, you know, went to replay it and was looking around the island and there's like a seagull in the sky.
Yeah.
They're like pinwheels around and then vanishes.
Yeah, so that was a lot of the innovation there was just in the presentation in making it look like you have this extremely high resolution, high color living world made out of a few little elements.
Yeah, it's like the opposite, the inverse of what Square did with some of its Final Fantasy movie integration in like the PS1 era.
Cut to
where
a
you would have, you know, like the background, the back static background image would transition into a movie. But then they would overlay a sprite on top
of
that.
Like
so you had
time,
like a real-time sprite. They really did that a lot with Final Fantasy 8 and 9.
Yeah.
So, you know, the background would become a movie, and then you would have like a very limited amount of control over your character. Mm-hmm. So you had like the real-time object over the animated background, whereas this is like the real-time, like the main background with like a fake movie playing over it that you had no control over. I don't know. Like, it makes sense in my head.
Yeah.
But you know, games of this era were very much about fudging it to create that cinematic immersive sensation despite the fact that they were using the same limited technology as everyone else.
Yeah, you don't have the data to actually do full screen video forever, and you don't have the processing power to just render stuff where you want it. So you have to fudge it, and right. They did a really good job.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a believer that technological limitations can lead to some great ideas, because you know, you tell someone they can't do something, and they're like, you know what, I'm going to figure out a way to do that.
Yeah.
And I mean, Myst is a great example of that. People can hate on it all they want, but it's a solid adventure game with some really interesting puzzles, and it fakes so much of like the idea of technology. I mean, yeah, the environments, like the rendered environments, they look pretty dated now. Lots of, you know, wet tile floors, you know, black and white grid tile. Okay. That's so like, you know, Splinter
it's
of the
Mind. I mean, at this
like
point,
Mind's Eye.
The Mind's Eye. I loved those. Yeah, at this point, it's nostalgic because it is the 3D graphics are very much of that early 3D mm-hmm. era. But not the like simplified early real time 3D, but the kind of 3D you get when you had all day to render it, and people would do interesting things. But it's still a very early point in the medium. So there's certain like signs that you can see that like, yeah, this is 90s, early 90s 3D mm-hmm. rendering, and that's
yeah. There's like 500 individual viewpoints in the game.
Oh, at least, yeah.
Something like that. So that's like a year's worth of rendering.
Yeah.
One of these images takes all day. And they probably
really
did because they had like ray casting and stuff
yeah.
like that.
Oh, yeah.
So they were really kind of pushing the back end technology and then making use of a very simple front end technology. Again, very much like Donkey Kong Country. Mm-hmm. And it created a very convincing illusion. And the fact that it was such a low stress game. So, you know, like you could get pretty stressed when you were stuck on a puzzle for a week, but, you know, it wasn't a challenging game in the finger dexterity sense, but rather yeah. mentally challenging. It made a game that, you know, had a very low barrier to entry and looked very inviting. So yeah, people were curious about it. It was a great demo game because even though it's super yeah. slow paced, it looked really great when you just kind of like you could pick up a mouse at a computer store and click around and be like, oh, this is very interesting. Oh, I see things that I'm supposed to do, like switches. You know, I mean, the switches and machines and stuff, those were just HyperCard buttons, but they looked like machines and mm-hmm. they drew you in and made you say, what am I supposed to do here? And there wasn't much to the game once you figured out the puzzles. Like you could literally complete the game in about 12 minutes once you knew everything you were supposed to do.
It could take longer than that, but. If you know the solution to the final puzzle,
like,
you can shortcut it all, sure. Yeah,
once you've done everything and solved all the puzzles, so you're just like, oh, I need to go get
the
pages.
You can go straight to the end, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
but I mean, that wasn't the point. The point was very much the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
And it was a very, at the time, large, sprawling, challenging game full of obscure puzzles.
Yeah, and I think the theme of figuring out how to do interesting things with limited resources is a good wrap up to this whole session, because that was very much the entire HyperCard gaming scene. Is like, you know, it's this easy to get into environment that draws people in, but then there's all these capabilities under the surface. So you get into it and then you're like, oh, well, I want to do this, and you're like, you're gonna do that in this environment? Well, okay, yeah, if you can figure out a way to do it, sure. And a lot of times you can, you know, you can do something clever with the tools that are available and make a lot of really weird, interesting stuff.
Wrap this with a few letters specifically pertaining to Myst. People wrote about HyperCard and Myst, but some of them were just about Myst. So this is one from Adam Middleton. My brother and I were a bit late to the party with Myst, not having played it until 1996, but it was still gorgeous enough to blow my mind. Even FMV felt futuristic to my 9-year-old self, but there were real people in my video game. Of course, I'd seen Toy Story when it came out, but this was different. This was happening in my computer. I mostly watched my brother play it because I didn't really have the patience to solve all those puzzles, and I kind of just wanted to see that wonderfully rendered 3D world. I lost interest when I found out you could basically beat the game from the beginning. I suppose I didn't yet understand that the journey was more important than the destination. Wow, I just said that. Super Mario 64 went on to set a new bar for exploration and immersion in 3D games later that year, but Myst still had a profound effect on my young gaming mind. To my recollection, it was the first my first PC adventure game, and I'm grateful that it set me on a path to playing many LucasArts and Sierra hits since. From some dude named Benj Edwards? What a weird name.
Yeah.
Sorry I couldn't make it there with you guys today, but I wanted to chip in some thoughts about one of the most often overlooked parts of the Myst franchise, Uru Live Online. Uru Live is an online MMO-like puzzle adventure game that launched in 2007. I think it started as an online component of the 2003 game Uru Ages Beyond Myst that never came out in its original form. I first played Uru Live in 2007 as part of a subscription I had to GameTap, and it felt awe-inspiring and wondrous to explore. The graphics were great at the time. The game wasn't very popular, but its mostly deserted nature actually made it a lot more fun. It felt almost shocking and world-breaking to run into someone when you found them, considering the context of the You're Usually All Alone Myst universe. The puzzles and atmospherics were amazing, but I only played Uru for a few months before I felt I had squeezed all I could get out of it. I probably only made one friend on there, and we tried to play a few puzzles together once, but it mostly felt like a single-player experience that just happened to have an online component. It did feel like it could have been a lot more, if enough people had played it. You had your own personal house that people could visit, if I recall correctly, but I don't think anyone ever saw mine. From what I know, Uru Live continued later on. I think I tried it briefly again once around 2010 when Cyan set up its own server for it, and went open source about a year later. Anyone curious about exploring the full depth of the Myst franchise should try it out at least once. Let's see. From Dylan G. My parents were never really into gaming except for a period of a few years in the early 90s when my family first got a computer with a CD-ROM drive. As such, I have a lot of memories of being a kid and watching my parents play CD-ROM games of the era, like The Seventh Guest, Under a Killing Moon, and of course, Myst. I was only a little kid in the 90s, so despite being intrigued by its mysterious world, the puzzles were too opaque for me to wrap my head around, even though our copy came with a hint book. A couple of years later, my family picked up a copy of Riven. I played around in it and never really made any progress, but I was impressed anyway with its sheer visual splendor. A few months later, my dad gave up trying to solve it and printed out, page by page, the walkthrough on GameSpot's website, just so he could see the ending. It wasn't until a number of years back, when Myst and Riven were re-released on Steam and GOG, that I went back and tried to solve them legitimately with an adult brain. I found Myst to be pretty doable with a relatively minor amount of note-taking. I only really struggled trying to parse with what the game was trying to communicate to me in the underground train puzzle,
with the sounds.
A puzzle Robin Miller called their worst puzzle in his post-mortem at GDC 2013. All in all, it's not a groundbreaking game by today's standards, but it revolutionized the genre in its time and holds up perfectly as a serviceable adventure game. Riven, on the other hand, now stands among my favorite video games of all time. Everything about the art direction holds up incredibly well for a game from 1997, from its stellar visual design to its chilling ambient soundtrack. Even the bits of FMV acting hold up, which is more than can be said of 99% of FMV acting. It's a tough game with only a vague stated goal at the outset. Find Catherine, capture Gen, Atrus's father, and send a signal back to Atrus. The game trusts the player to suss out how to go about those objectives. While there are a couple of annoying pixel hunts, they're relatively few and far between. It's a game that makes me envious of people who get to experience it for the first time, and there's never been a better time to play it than now that it can be obtained digitally without the need for constantly swapping the 5 CDs it originally shipped on. Yep. And there's a photo of the GameSpot guide printed out in black and white and stapled together.
Nice.
That's impressive.
Yeah. I think that's another good point, though, that like where a lot of games with full motion video shoehorned in just end up being kind of annoying and overacted, that they did a really good job with a restrained use of video games. And again, partly that was because of necessity that, you know, they have very little space to work with. But, you know, they have these green screened actors superimposed in just little snippets. And they did a really good job in most of these games of just, you know, believably fitting them into the world and not having them overstay their welcome.
Yeah, I agree. So I don't know. I feel like the Myst series is due for reconsideration by people. It's been written off so unfairly, I think, by people who are like, oh, it's too simple, it's too stupid, there's nothing there's no substance.
So, you know, the Wikipedia page has a quote from you on it about Myst ruining the adventure genre.
I did not say that it is.
No, not in those words.
I said that people have complained that it ruined the adventure genre. Okay,
That's fair.
I was citing other people. I hold with that perspective.
I think Wikipedia is misrepresenting you on that page.
Those bastards. That's what happens when you let anyone edit.
Yep.
Democracy is our death. No, I have never said that Myst ruined video games. Yeah. I have said that people complained about that and that there is a lot to be said for Myst.
Yeah, and I think from our perspective today, it's easier to see that Myst was really the beginning of a divergent genre from the LucasArts style of adventure games, and that there's a place for both. You know, you have these adventure games with complicated inventories and systems and puzzles that are solved, including, you know, lots of objects and menus and stuff, and there's a perfectly good place for that. And then there's this other genre that's very stripped down and very much about just the player in the world with as little interface as possible. And you know, these can both coexist just fine.
Mm-hmm. The great thing about video games is there's so many different ways to interpret the idea of video game. It doesn't all have to be the same. And Myst, I think, has a lot going for it. And I have all three novels. I haven't read them since they first came out.
I read one or two of them, and it was a long time ago. Yeah.
They were pretty interesting. Not the greatest prose I've ever read, but
all right,
enjoyable. Like I like that there's so much thought put into the world of the games. And, you know, as a writer, I can definitely appreciate a game created by a writer about writers, about the power of words.
Yep.
I'm like, yeah, that speaks to me.
Yep. You know,
it's kind of like Stephen King always making his protagonist a novelist. Yep. So anyway, that I think wraps it up for Myst and Hypercard. I feel like we've kind of covered the gamut of this topic.
Yeah, I think so.
And especially thanks to everyone who wrote in. There were some great letters, some very interesting insights and anecdotes. So thanks everyone who took the time to write in. Be sure to check retronauts.com on a regular basis and check my Twitter feed, twitter.com/gamespite, because I put out calls for letters from time to time. And I appreciate the fact that so many people wrote in this time. Sometimes we get like two or three, but we got a ton this time. So that's awesome. Anyway, so yes, Retronauts, another episode down. Thanks, Ben, for coming in to chat about Myst and Hypercard and share your experiences. And
always a pleasure.
Bring in all this stuff, and we'll have you on again sometime again soon. I don't know when. It's always a mystery. Things aren't planned out that well.
Yep.
So anyway, Retronauts, the podcast, can be found at retronauts.com, on iTunes, on Podcast One, and on the Podcast One app. We're supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. If you support us for $3 a month, you'll get to download podcasts a week early in higher bandwidth, bit rate. Yes, that's it. And without advertisements. So that's pretty cool. And of course, you can keep reading retronauts.com because we publish stuff there every day about video games, mostly old video games. I'm on Twitter, I said, as GameSpite, and Retronauts is on Twitter as Retronauts. We're on Facebook. YouTube, oh my God. It's just
all the places.
If you look for Retronauts, you're going to find us. It's pretty easy. Ben, what about you?
So you can find me on Twitter at Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N, with an extra N because the original one was taken. And you can also find a retro-focused blog of mine at kirinsretrocloset.tumblr.com. That's Kirin with one N there. I'll try to post up some of the visual aids relevant to this episode near when it goes up, but you can always also just search the Retronauts tag on Kieran's Retro Closet to find relevant things. And yeah, if you want to try out some of this Hypercard stuff, do check. I think we're going to try to put this in the show notes, the archive.org archives. There's a bunch of stuff you can play there. If you want to actually try it out writing stuff yourself, you're probably going to have to go to old Macintosh OS emulation, which is a bigger topic than we're going to cover in the outro, but the resources are out there. It can be done. So,
all right. Thanks, Ben. Thanks everyone for listening. Thanks everyone for writing. As always, we'll be back again in 1 week with another full episode and on alternating Fridays with the bonus micro episode. When I say bonus micro, I mean probably nearly a full episode because we've lost the plot. It's terrible. Anyway, bear with us. We'll keep talking. Thanks.
You normally have 3 opportunities per year to see Retronauts live. This year, we've been to Midwest Gaming Classic, Long Island Retro Gaming Expo, and Portland Retro Gaming Expo. But it's almost Thanksgiving, so we're going to give you one last reason to be thankful in 2017. Chris Sims and I, which is to say Retronauts East, will be putting in some appearances at Super Famicon in Greensboro, North Carolina, just down the road from where we live, as a bonus 2017 live appearance. Look for us on the floor and on panels on November 18th and 19th. We'll be talking to Luke Edwards, star of The Wizard, looking at the history and impact of Night Trap with the guys from Limited Run Games, and more. That's Super Famicon in Greensboro, North Carolina, November 18th and 19th. Be there, or wait for the live recordings, I guess.